Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about Santa Fe New Music's new concert that's coming up on Thursday night that takes on both sounds and issues surrounding the Everglades. Right now, I would like to welcome Dr. John Fogarty. He is a family physician. He's president of New Energy Economy. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Great to have you.
Great to be here.
So let's talk about climate change, which is probably not quite enough on everybody's mind. One of the things that has happened, I've been doing shows about climate change for 4 or 5 years, and one of the things I've noticed is that the predictions that scientists have made about the progression of climate change have been very conservative, which means that climate change is advancing at a much more rapid pace than has been predicted.
Yeah, we're seeing incredible changes right now, and I think everyone right now has the economy on their minds, and I think that that's very important, especially as we think about climate change, because what hasn't been part of the public discourse is the impact that climate change will have on the overall economy in New Mexico as well as around the world. There were some good studies that were just released recently from the University of New Mexico and the University of Oregon, which showed that climate change in New Mexico by mid-century could cost New Mexican families up to $5,000 a year. So really tremendous economic impacts.
And in what way? How would it cost families that?
Well, it's going to have an effect on climate changes in the Southwest. Is going to have an effect on increasing drought. There's going to be a dramatic reduction of water resources, both surface and groundwater resources.
So lower crop yields?
Lower crop yields, more expensive for communities that want to purchase water, an effect on growth of cities and communities. It's going to have an effect on agriculture, for sure. It will have an effect on our forests and the health of our forests. We'll see more wildfires. There's estimates that we'll see four times as many wildfires. The wildfire season is already lengthening. The intensity of wildfires will grow. So we're going to see overall tremendous impact on our water resources, on our agriculture, but also on public health. Through diminished air quality, through more heat waves. We're looking in New Mexico where Santa Fe may have the climate more akin to Albuquerque. Albuquerque will have a climate more like Phoenix.
That's a very big change.
Huge change. And that's really insignificant compared to the changes that we're already seeing. And you hit on this, Mary Charlotte, and I think it's really important for listeners to realize how dramatically things are changing throughout the world. In the Arctic, for example, we're seeing huge changes that go far beyond what we expected even just 5-6 years ago. When I started working in earnest on climate change back in 2003, the best available models predicted that half of the ice in the Arctic would be melted by the year 2100. By 2005, they revised that prediction to 2050. In 2007, it was revised down to 2030. And now there's scientists that say that by 2015, all of the ice in the Arctic in the summer will be gone.
That's 5 years from now.
5 years from now. Absolutely. Incredible changes. Incredible melting in Greenland. Incredible melting throughout the Antarctic.
So what happens when that much water melts? Does it raise the levels of the ocean?
Not with the Arctic, because that's actually floating on the... It's like an ice cube
in
a cup. But what is really, truly scary is the melting in Greenland and the melting in the Antarctic, where we're seeing accelerated melting. I talked with a friend of mine who went up there last year to Greenland, and he said instead of white, it's actually Greenland is becoming blue because the glaciers are melting and you're getting enormous lakes, many miles of lakes. And that is causing increased warming because the blue absorbs the heat as opposed to reflecting the heat as the glaciers do. So we're getting this cycle of warming and local warming, which is accelerating the global temperature rise, as well as the effects in the Arctic. So temperatures have risen in the Arctic by up to 10 degrees already in the North and the South Pole. And we're seeing the changes where forests are collapsing because the permafrost is melting, and communities are, the Native American communities up in northern Alaska are very concerned about their livelihood because things are changing so dramatically. And we here in New Mexico are going to see that be really on the next on the list in terms of impact. Scientists predict prolonged and sustained droughts in the long run here. Scientists say very clearly that the Southwest United States is going to be one of the first and most heavily impacted areas in the United States. Some scientists are predicting what's called Dust Bowl conditions, where there will be dramatically decreased water resources, and coupled with increases in temperatures, as we talked about. So huge impacts that may only be a decade away for our state.
Another thing that is important to talk about is that the Amazon rainforest, which has always been, because there's so many trees there, an absorber of carbon dioxide, is now undergoing a drought to the point where they're not even, not only are they not absorbing it, they're actually producing, they're emitting carbon dioxide.
Yeah, that's something called a positive feedback effect. And we're seeing that all around the world, where the changes in the climate are actually causing sinks of carbon to be released. One example in particular, in addition to the Amazonian rainforest, is the Siberian permafrost. And warming right now, as I mentioned, in the Arctic, it has gone up between 5 and 10 degrees. That's causing permafrost, which has been frozen for tens of thousands of years, to melt. And doesn't sound that dangerous, but when you consider the fact that the permafrost holds literally gigatons of methane, and methane is a very, very potent greenhouse gas.
Far more so than carbon dioxide.
Far more, 25 times as much as carbon dioxide. So what I think is potentially frightening and catastrophic for humanity and future generations is that we may, because of man-made global warming, trigger a vicious cycle of runaway global warming, where our warming has melted the permafrost, released methane. The methane will trigger more and more warming, and that will release more and more methane, more and more warming, etc., and going on and on, so that we see really dramatic and irreversible changes in temperature. And I think that's why scientists are saying we need to act now. We need to do something now. We can't wait any longer. Congress is acting like, oh, well, we can just wait another 20 years, 30 years before we really take action. But the truth of the matter is we need to act now before these positive feedback loops kick in.
I think it's really important to point out the difference between this and every other issue that humanity has ever faced. You know, we fight for the vote. Women fight for the vote, and eventually they get the vote. You know, abolitionists fight against slavery. Eventually, slavery ends. If it doesn't end this year, it ends next year. If it doesn't end this century, it ends next century. With climate change, we've got a deadline. We've never had a deadline on anything before.
Right. You know, I think about it as a physician. The way our policymakers are acting, it's kind of like if your father, Mary Charlotte, were to come in and say, come into an emergency room, and they said, well, you need a triple bypass surgery. And the doctor says, well, we're only going to do one of the grafts this year. In 20 years, we'll think about doing another one. In 40 years, we'll think about doing another one. And the climate is similar. It's like we can't wait another 40 years before we really take action. And that's the way our politicians have been acting. They're acting like, oh, well, we can do a little something now, and then 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now, we'll actually really get serious. And for the reasons I mentioned, the major positive feedback loops, the melting of the Antarctic and the Greenland, we have to take action now.
We're talking to Dr. John Fogarty, president of New Energy Economy. So there are three major ways that politicians are looking at to actually reduce carbon emissions. One of them is tax, one is cap and trade, and the third is cap and dividend, and we're going to talk about all of them. Let's start with a carbon tax. What does that mean?
You're right. There's three major policy vehicles that could be used. Carbon tax would simply put a price on carbon that is being emitted into the atmosphere. So essentially, it would work like a tax on sulfur dioxide or nitrogen oxides or any other kind of pollution that polluters are putting into the atmosphere.
Do we have a model for that?
Sure. There's models that have been developed around any kind of pollutant that polluters put into the environment. And the nice thing about it is it's simple. If a polluter puts a ton of carbon into the atmosphere, they pay a tax.
The only trick is you've got to measure it.
Exactly. And I think that's why it would be important to tax carbon where it came into the economy, for example, from oil refineries or from coal mines. It actually would be fairly easy to do, and it probably would only regulate maybe 1,000 companies that put the carbon into our economy. You wouldn't put a tax on everybody's bill, their monthly electricity bill. It actually would be farther up the line in terms of where the coal came out of the mine or where the natural gas came out of the well.
So, of course, there are two problems with tax. One is that it's not politically viable, or it's difficult to get taxes through in this country because so many people are anti-tax. And the other thing is that people are afraid that taxes will cause higher prices for their energy, on their energy bills.
Yeah, I think the tax on the surface is something that is not politically very palatable right now. That being said, some major players in the energy world, such as ExxonMobil, not exactly a friend that has been working for climate solutions, but ExxonMobil believes that a tax would be the best thing to do to solve climate change because it's the simplest, and it would be fair across the board. So there would be no giveaways to, say, concessions to the coal companies or the natural gas companies. Everybody would be taxed accordingly. And it has engendered the support of even conservative lawmakers like Republican Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, who said, you know, frankly, if we're going to have a climate program, it should be a tax.
So the second one is cap and trade, and there is a cap and trade bill in Congress right now, correct?
There is, and I think this is probably the most important issue for listeners to tune in right now, because this bill has the potential of being the largest corporate welfare program ever enacted in the history of the United States. And those aren't my words. Those are the words of Peter Orszag, who's the director of Office of Management and Budget. He said last fall that if this bill passes, basically it's going to provide hundreds of billions of dollars of giveaways for energy corporations, for utilities, for carbon traders for decades to come. And I think that is just really a crime.
Now, why is that? Explain it.
Well, the way that the cap and trade bill was written, and I think it's important to note that it was written by energy corporations and by utilities for their benefit. And the way that it's written is that you would cap emissions, there would be permits that would be issued, and instead of paying for those permits would just be given away to the polluters. So the largest polluters historically would be given the largest number of free permits or allowances. And what the energy companies have said is that, well, if you give us those permits, then we'll, quote, pass the savings along to the consumer. And I think that that's just absurd. It's kind of like saying if you gave Peabody Coal Company all the tickets to the World Series, would they give those tickets back to the people for free, or would they sell them at the best price? And of course they would sell them. And that's, I think, the real problem with the cap and trade bill is it provides long-term corporate welfare for some of the biggest corporations in our world.
I'd like to also say that every single time that I have, in the time that I've been observing this, whether we're talking about Wall Street banks and the whole mortgage crisis and so on, that legislation has been enacted that favors corporations with the rationale that they will pass on their savings to consumers, to the regular people. I can't think of an example where that has ever happened. Ever.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think people are getting wise to it, thank God. And the other part of the cap and trade bill that I think is important to point out is that it would create this trading scheme. Wall Street is actually salivating at the idea of creating a cap-and-trade bill because it would create this new market. And the cap-and-trade bill that passed the House last June allows for carbon traders, basically investors, Wall Street investors, to get into the act. Even though they would provide nothing of value to the system, they would just be in the act trading carbon permits around the world.
And getting fees and percentage
and
points.
Huge fees. And making bets about where they could save money and where they could move the permits around to.
Making bets. This is sounding very familiar.
Very familiar. And, again, this cap and trade bill, as Peter Orszag said, the biggest corporate welfare program ever enacted. And so it's a benefit to Wall Street. It's a benefit to the major energy companies. And
under the guise of, hey, the market solves all problems.
Right, and we've seen how well that worked for the banking industry or the housing industry.
So the third is cap and dividend. Explain that.
Yeah, and I think that this is a very smart proposal. It's very simple. It's fair. It's just. And the way it works is like this. Polluters, energy companies like coal companies, for example, would be forced to bid in an auction if they want to continue to pollute with carbon. That money would then go into a fund that would be rebated back to taxpayers. And we have helped out with some studies with the University of Massachusetts, which show that 80% of Americans actually would do better with this bill. Because under this bill that was introduced by Maria Cantwell, a Democrat from Washington, and Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine.
So this is actually in...
This is actually a bill called the CLEAR Act, the Carbon Limits and Energy for America's Renewal, the CLEAR Act. It was introduced in December, and that bill would cap emissions. Polluters would pay for the right to pollute. 75% of the revenues actually would be returned back to taxpayers. 25% would be invested into clean energy technologies. And under that bill, the average American family would receive $1,100 back each year. And so that would do two things. One, it would buffer American families from rising energy costs. Number two, it would stimulate the investment of huge amounts of capital that is waiting to invest in clean energy and clean technology. There was a meeting just last month in New York City, investors from all around the world representing more than $2 trillion of capital. Said, what we need is carbon, a price on carbon. And if we have a price on carbon and we have that assurance that there's going to be some regulation on climate, we're ready to invest. $2 trillion. I mean, talk about an opportunity to jumpstart our economy, create jobs, create new businesses, new industry. So I think the cap and dividend bill, it makes sense for Americans, it makes sense for our economy, and it's something that listeners can get involved right now. It's really critical that our congressional delegation, specifically Tom Udall and Jeff Bingaman, get involved. They need to become co-sponsors of this bill.
We're talking to Dr. John Fogarty. He's the president of New Energy Economy. So this is called the CLEAR Act. It's a cap and dividend act. So the revenue would go toward both dividends that would go back to, as you say, to the consumer, but also to programs like reforestation, agriculture, renewable energy, things like that.
Exactly. So we would not only be investing in American families, but we would be investing in the jobs of the future. Right now, the United States is getting left behind. The United States invented solar energy, invented wind energy. 10 years ago, just a decade ago.
We invented wind energy?
I thought
windmills were from Holland.
Well, in terms of being able to translate it into electricity, it was work done at the national labs and really perfected it. If you look at the leaders in wind energy, the United States dominated the world market even into the 90s. But in the last 10, 15 years, we have fallen way behind. In fact, in solar energy, here in New Mexico, the wealth of solar resources right here, we are falling dreadfully behind. China is now the world leader in solar energy, soon to be the world leader in wind energy. They see the writing on the wall that the future in the economy is based on clean energy, and they're investing in it. We, unfortunately, are not.
So you are the president of New Energy Economy, and you have petitioned the New Mexico Environmental Improvement Board. Tell us about that whole petition.
Sure. New Energy Economy, we've been working very hard on climate policy, both at state level and federal level, and we believe very firmly that we need federal legislation. That being said, Congress has been dragging its feet for literally decades. The first congressional hearing on climate change was in 1978. We still haven't seen any substantive bill to date. So in the absence of federal leadership, we think it's incumbent upon states to step up to the plate. And a few states are. California and Massachusetts have passed legislation and are moving ahead. And we believe New Mexico has a real opportunity by passing climate legislation. And in 2008, we petitioned the Environmental Improvement Board to set a cap on global warming emissions. Very simple program, essentially saying that large polluters in the state, polluters that emit more than 25,000 tons of carbon dioxide, would have to reduce their emissions. And we asked the Environmental Improvement Board to do it, set a cap based on science, based on what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change recommends that all developed nations do. So specifically, we asked for a 25% reduction below 1990 levels by 2020. And we think...
Which is still pretty conservative, really, when you look at what's needed.
Well, true. The IPCC said that all developed nations needed to reduce emissions by 25 to 40% below 1990 levels by 2020. A lot of scientists since that time, including James Hansen, the prominent scientist from NASA, said that's not enough. We're already starting to see these positive feedback loops. We're seeing dramatic melting in the Arctic. We have to take action right now and reduce our emissions dramatically.
And, ladies and gentlemen, positive feedback loops are not positive for the environment.
not positive at all. I mean, precisely. It'll kick out more and more carbon dioxide, more and more carbon, cause more and more warming, and really lead to runaway climate change. Will have disastrous impacts on future generations.
So this basically represents trying to work at a state level, and that brings up the whole question of whether states can be as effective doing all this work state by state versus doing it on the federal level.
Well, I think states and cities can be very, very effective. And in fact, I think the only reason why we have any substantive discussion going on in Congress right now about federal climate legislation is because of the work that's been happening at the state and regional level. If they did not have that pressure, I can guarantee you that they would not be acting. So the fact that Massachusetts and California have already started to move on this is putting pressure. But if you get a state that's an energy-producing state, like New Mexico, acting on climate, it really begins to perk up ears. And we're already starting to see attention nationally on our petition. The LA Times just ran a story last month. And we think that if federal legislation falls apart, which it looks like it has a chance of doing, there's going to be a lot of eyes focused on this effort here in New Mexico.
Now, there are some hearings coming up.
There are. On March 1st, there will be hearings here in Santa Fe. That's this coming Monday. And there are public hearings where people from all around the state are being invited to speak about why they think we should take action on climate change. It's at the Ortiz Building at 2600 Cerrillos Road. It starts at 10 a.m. on Monday, March 1st. And we know that there are going to be a diverse representation there. We have young people from some of the schools. Santa Fe Prep is coming. We have ranchers from the northwest part of the state. Chris Velasquez, who worked for many years ranching, has a large ranch up in the northwest part of the state. He's going to come and talk about how oil and gas has been disastrous for the environment, disastrous for the water. We have CEOs from large energy companies like SkyFuel, Vought Power, Clean Switch, Positive Energy. Pediatric Society is coming. Voices for Children. Labor groups like Working America. rural representation, people coming from Mortar County, Wagon Mound, Union County. So really it's a diverse showing that will be there on Monday, and we invite all of your listeners to come out and join us.
And so what will actually be heard?
The Environmental Improvement Board is taking testimony from the public about why we need action on climate change. And so they're hearing from renewable energy companies saying, look, if we put a price on carbon, if we begin to reduce carbon, it creates a huge incentive to develop our solar resources, our wind resources. They're going to be hearing from Native Americans talking about the impacts of why it's affecting their traditional grazing lands. They're going to be hearing from school children saying, hey, we've looked at this science, and we need to take action right now. It's going to affect our generation. So it's a chance for the public to input to the Environmental Improvement Board, and for them, the Environmental Improvement Board, to hear from New Mexicans about why we need action on climate change.
When you read this whole list, it represents such a wide segment of New Mexicans, and it really brings up this whole question of the democratic process at work. What's going on here? Is the democratic process working in New Mexico?
Well, I think the Environmental Improvement Board is really a unique venue where citizens of the state can actually say, hey, look, we need to take an action here. And that's what we've done. A citizens group has petitioned the board. Many other organizations have joined in the co-petition. For example, Pediatric Society, Voices for Children, League of Women Voters, prominent groups from around the state saying, yeah, we need to take action. And I think that that's really an important step for democracy. And the hearings on Monday are really a unique opportunity for the public to get involved and act on something that could result in some real meaningful policy for the state. The fundamental problem that we face right now, I think, it's not a climate crisis. It's not an energy crisis. It's not an environmental crisis. It's actually a crisis of democracy. And for too long, Congress has been controlled by large energy corporations, controlled by the interests of a few. And now is the time for Americans to come together and say, we need a different direction for energy in our country. We need to start creating clean energy that is going to re-energize our economy. We need to start developing our solar energy in New Mexico, which really is going to revolutionize our economy. But we need leadership, and our leaders need to begin to hear from the public that this is something that we demand. This is something that can't wait any longer. And again, I encourage all your listeners to get involved. They can go to newenergyeconomy.org to learn more and to get involved. We really need to build a movement and hold our legislators, our policymakers, congressional leaders accountable.
And it is a challenge at this point because corporations do have so very much power in comparison even to powerful citizens groups.
That's right. That's right. They certainly have the mouthpiece. They have the money to put into large TV ads and full-page ads in the papers. But what we have is a vision. We have a vision for a better future for our state, for our country, for our world. And I think when people start hearing that this is the life that we could create for our children, that we can protect our environment, that we can create a long-lasting, prosperous economy that doesn't devastate our economy. People are engaged, and people get it. They know that we need to get off Middle East oil. They know that we need to stop putting up coal-fired power plants that are causing asthma and heart attacks throughout the state. They know that when they look out the window that there's tremendous sun there, and it's going to waste, and we have a real opportunity right now. So now is the time that we make this push. Senator Bingaman, Senator Udall are in key positions to influence federal climate legislation. And frankly, they need calls. They need to hear from constituents saying that we need action on climate change. We need to support a bill that would be fair, that would help American families. And that is the CLEAR Act. Again, I encourage people to make calls to the congressional delegation saying, let's take action. Let's support a cap and dividend bill that would be good for all Americans.
John Fogarty is a family physician. He's the president of New Energy Economy, that once again is on the web at newenergyeconomy.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mayor Charlotte.
And if people want to find out more about these hearings on Monday, is there a number they can call, or I guess it would be on your website?
You can go to newenergyeconomy.org, and there's a lot of information there, and we would love to see you there.
Excellent. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm delighted now to welcome John Baer. He is a baritone, and he will be performing in a performance tomorrow night called Pahayoki, A Plea for Life at Tipton Hall on the College of Santa Fe campus, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. And it's part of Santa Fe New Music's presentation. The Plea for Life is about the Everglades. We're going to be talking about that. Welcome, John, to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here.
And Reese Peterson is with us. She is the executive director of the Santa Fe Conservation Trust, for whom this concert is a benefit. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here, and we're delighted to be in cahoots with Santa Fe New Music.
Now, this Pahayoki, A Plea for Life, is basically an environmental oratorio that is about and uses sound from the Everglades in Florida.
That's correct. It's a sort of a plea to help save the Everglades. The Everglades is a natural ecosystem that's basically a slow-moving river that flows in Florida.
Absolutely,
about a mile a day. And because of water control devices, humans siphoning off water from the glades and setting up dikes and levees and dams and things like that, it stops the flow of the Everglades, and it is killing the ecosystem. And because it's such a fragile place, and about 50% of it is gone now. And if we don't do something very, very soon, it'll all be gone. And it's such a beautiful and marvelous place that it'd be a shame for future generations not to be able to enjoy it.
And it's environmentally very important for many species, not to mention water supply for human beings.
Absolutely. So many bird species have already gone extinct. Again, everything, it really is a fragile ecosystem. When one thing doesn't work, then certain species die out. And it's all human encroachment. The city, the megalopolis of Miami, it comes right up to the Everglades now. And so we just have to make it so the Everglades can stay as they are now. It'd be tough to get them back to 100%, but the important thing is to keep them as they are.
So Jack Tamil is the composer of this piece, and he did a lot of recording of environmental sound. Is that correct?
That's right. A lot of the sounds that you hear in the piece are actually, well, all of the ambient sounds are from the Everglades. He took high-tech equipment and went out and recorded sounds, mostly at night. And some of it is just really incredible. You'll be sitting, and basically all you hear is this huge sound. And it's just frogs and insects, and it's overwhelming. It's really incredible.
It's interesting. I mean, you are a baritone with this very distinguished opera background, which is so, I don't know how to say it, but like indoorsy cultural as a as a music form. What is it like to be essentially in collaboration with non-human musical species sounds?
It's actually really fascinating and exciting and fun. It's definitely a different medium than I'm used to, but you know, sometimes it's great to break out of that mold and to try something new and try something fresh. And I just think it's beautiful, and it's so much fun, and it's interesting to be able to work with electronics. One of the things I do on stage is sort of orchestrate many of the sounds that happen, and some of my voice is dubbed over, which I play, which is sometimes intimidating to be singing with yourself. It's fun. It's been a lot of work, but it's also very rewarding.
Now, your father, David Baer, is the pianist, and he's going to be on this piece as well.
Yes. He has been in collaboration since the beginning. He's on the CD recording, and he played when we did the concert in Philadelphia.
Now, Jim Miller wrote the libretto, essentially. He is an attorney and an environmental activist,
yes.
And he grew up around the Everglades, and I guess he will be speaking, but he also wrote the text.
He did, and his passion and love of the Everglades, I think, really shines through when you listen to and hear the text. He has so much respect and love for this ecosystem, and as he, again, I mean, over just the past 20, 30 years, he's just seen the kind of decline that's been happening, and it takes a toll on him. It's because, I mean, he has a house there, he spends much of his time there, and so he's frightened for the Everglades, and I think it comes through. His love of it, the beautiful parts of the Everglades shine through in the piece, but also this real plight, this idea that if we don't act now, it could be lost forever, and that's very scary.
One of the themes that has been coming up for me over and over again is the conflict between two philosophies. One is that humans are here to basically dominate the earth, and the other is that we are here to share the earth with everybody else. And the latter is not really in the forefront right now. I mean, certainly a lot of people believe that on a spiritual level, but in terms of the way the economy works and the way human migration patterns work, we are taking over in a way that's not working.
I think that's true. On the other hand, I think people are becoming more and more aware of the impact that human activity has had on the Earth, especially since we've become so technologically adept as a species. We've multiplied population far beyond what the Earth would normally be able to carry. We are very excited at the Santa Fe Conservation Trust. As you know, we're the local land trust. We help to provide communities and landowners with opportunities to conserve land and the land through which the water flows. We are very pleased that the Santa Fe New Music has chosen us to be partners with this wonderful oratorio, and we're very grateful that people like John Baer, Jack Tamil, James Miller are sharing with us their generosity to help connect Santa Fe audiences with the issues about land and water as well. I was very impressed that James Miller, who John has just mentioned, is very connected to the Florida landscape and the Everglades, to be able to make that connection with the desert landscape as well. He understands that our issues here largely have to do with water and water supply, clean water, and water security for both people and wildlife.
Well, and that is such an interesting connection. Florida, which is so wet, and Santa Fe, or northern New Mexico, the desert, which are so dry, are dealing with the same issues in ways that are far more similar than they might appear on the surface.
Oh, absolutely. They're very connected and very similar. Because it's all about water. The Everglades is all about water. And I think Santa Fe and New Mexico, water conservation and water supply, and again, as we just mentioned, sharing it between humans and animals, sharing it with the land, but also having enough for the people, but really understanding that the environment is so important. And if we take it for granted and don't share the water, that some of it might go away. It might not be around for very much longer.
Well, and as we talked about in the last segment, the potential effects and the already real effects of climate change, besides, I mean, the reality of taking the water out of the rivers and so on, but the effects of climate change include massive droughts and the drying up of the fresh water that we have.
Absolutely. And, I mean, again, because every ecosystem is so fragile and every species depends on one another, when you take away certain water, then sometimes then the ground becomes so dry that when rains do actually come, they cause more floods. And so even though it seems like there's enough water, it's actually hurting the ecosystem because it's not used to having that kind of strain imposed upon it.
Why don't we hear a little bit of this piece that people are going to be able to hear tomorrow night at Tipton Hall, Pahayoki, A Plea for Life. The piece that we're about to hear is called
Prayer for Pahayoki.
Okay, and this is you singing.
Yes, this is me singing. There's some piano and also some ambient sounds. And this song is basically talking about what the Everglades are, but also what they need. Needing water, needing rain. And it's a beautiful piece that sort of embodies the peacefulness and tranquility of the glades.
Okay, let's hear it.
Sacred grassy waters, bringing life to of sawgrass, trying hard to outlast humans coming in waves.
And that was an excerpt from a prayer for Pahayoki. What is that name, Pahayoki? That sounds like an Indian name.
It is. It is the Seminole Native American word for the Everglades, river of grass, which is basically, when you look out over the Everglades, a lot of it is just one flowing grassland. And when you see the wind ripple through it, it's almost like waves on water. It's really incredible. And when the first explorers came to the Everglades, they called it the Everglades. Because it's just one big glade, and it goes on what looks like forever. I don't believe that the topography ever gets above about a foot above sea level. And so as you gaze out across it, it basically becomes one with the sky, making you believe that it goes on forever. So it's a very beautiful place.
So this is just a taste of what people will hear tomorrow night at the concert at Tipton Hall. It's from Santa Fe New Music, and the Santa Fe Art Institute are collaborating, and it's a benefit for the Santa Fe Conservation Trust, of which you, Reese Peterson, are the executive director. Tell us about some of the projects that you're doing.
Well, we are working with landowners all throughout the northern counties of New Mexico, Santa Fe County, San Miguel County, Rio Arriba County. In particular, our latest projects have been to help protect in perpetuity land along the Los Pinos River in northern New Mexico, which has some of the most pristine trout habitat in the state, incredibly untouched, beautiful views and forests, meadows, a gorgeous river runs through it. We are also working with landowners along the Pecos River, the upper Pecos River, basically upstream of I-25 and upstream of the village of Pecos. Lots of landowners there are collaborating with us to protect hundreds of acres along that area. As you listeners probably know, to protect clean waters and water supplies, we have to have open natural lands, both so that the water is not contaminated as it flows over the land, and also open natural lands help us to recharge our groundwater supplies for wells, for rivers, for springs, for wildlife, and for people. So
yeah,
we work all over New Mexico to protect the land that protects the waters that people and wildlife need.
That continuity between land and water, which you were talking about in the Everglades, is also so true in New Mexico. I mean, it's called a watershed because it's a very large area that feeds into the actual streams and rivers.
That's right. A watershed is the land over which precipitation flows to create rivers.
Hmm. And if that's all houses and asphalt, it doesn't work.
Exactly. It starts to starve the system in so many levels, just like is what's happening at the Everglades.
Absolutely.
John Baer, did you go to the Everglades? I know you're not from there, but to prepare for singing this piece about the Everglades?
Yes, I did. I wanted to go down and see for myself what all the talk was about, and I wasn't disappointed. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous place, and it is like being on another planet. You go, and there are just there's so much diversity of animal and plant life, and one of the ways that Jim describes it, which I think is so interesting, is that it's this sort of completely serene and peaceful environment, and then suddenly there'll be an explosion of life. There'll be a lightning strike that causes a wildfire, or there'll be an alligator that jumps out of the water and snags prey. It's not this tumultuous, active place. It's a really peaceful, serene place, and then there'll be these huge explosions of life that are, and it's so interesting to see. It's really beautiful. It's incredible.
And that suggests all kinds of interesting rhythms that have musical possibilities.
Absolutely. Dynamics as well. Sometimes it'll be quiet, and then there'll be an explosion of a forte. And also different tempi, different rhythms. The first song is very rhythmic, and is a little bit. It's sort of the beginning starts off as just a plea. A plea for life, as it's called, that sort of discusses when you go there, when you've been there and you've seen it, you really do care. It makes you just want to make sure this thing is around forever. And so the first song is sort of a help, please. You know, we have to do something now. And as it goes on, each song has a different feel. Each song has a different point of view. Sometimes I'm speaking in first person as the Everglades. Sometimes I'm talking about the Everglades, what they need. Other times it's just the last song, for instance, is very rhythmic and very fun, talking about the types of life that are in the Everglades and sort of a sound recreation of what the Everglades are. So it's really beautiful. It's tonal music, and I think people are really going to enjoy it. It's something that you can definitely latch on to. Also, you can listen to, and it's very soothing, but also very interesting. It's very much a beautiful piece that I think people will really respond well to and very much enjoy listening to.
So one thing that comes up for people when we are discussing the various environmental crises around us is, well, I'm not in denial about it. I understand what's going on, but what can I do? Well, actually, the way this is set up, that something that you actually can do is show up tomorrow night, Thursday night, February 25th at 7 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. It's a Santa Fe New Music production co-sponsored with the Santa Fe Art Institute, and it's called Pahayoki, A Plea for Life. And what it does is it benefits the Santa Fe Conservation Trust so that they can actually do the work of land conservation. Reese Peterson is the executive director of that organization, which is on the web at
sfct.org. Tickets are available online, but you can also buy them at the door.
And John Baer is a baritone. He will be performing along with his father, David Baer, on piano, and James Miller, the environmentalist, attorney, sound recordist, and librettist of this piece, will be there, and the composer as well?
Jack Tamil, yes, he'll be there.
Jack Tamil. So we will see you all tomorrow night. Thank you so much for being with us.
Looking forward to seeing you tomorrow night, everybody.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.